The CBS News Weekend Roundup after this short break.
Don't have time to keep up with the news? Try the CBS News Radio app on your iOS or Android device. You'll get the latest news as soon as you start it up.
CBS News Special Report.
It's that easy. You can also listen to great programming like Face the Nation, Weekend Roundup, or the CBS Evening News with Jeff Glor.
We're going to begin with our interview with the president late this afternoon.
You can even download them straight to your phone and listen later. It's all on the CBS News Radio app for iOS or Android. Download it today. This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
Longtime defender of President Trump, Michael Cohen, sentenced to prison.
Cohen was sentenced to serve 3 years in federal prison for lying to Congress, tax evasion, and campaign finance violations.
Plus, tipsters lead French police to a man accused of a gun rampage.
More than 800 calls were made to the police call line.
And now, from the Capital One Bank studios in the CBS News Washington Bureau, here's correspondent Steve Dorsey.
Let's start this weekend with the president's former longtime personal attorney, Michael Cohen, who's heading to prison and now speaking out to ABC News as President Trump fires back on Fox.
In an interview with ABC News, President Trump's former fixer, Michael Cohen, says Mr. Trump asked him to buy the silence of porn star Stormy Daniels and Playboy model Karen McDougal.
He directed me to make the payments. He directed me to become involved in these matters.
CBS News sources confirm the president was in the room when Cohen and National Enquirer publisher David Pecker discussed paying hush money to the women in August of 2015. Collectively, Cohen paid them $280,000, which could be a campaign finance violation.
You have to remember at what point in time that this matter came about, 2 weeks or so before the election, post the Billy Bush comments. So yes, he was very concerned about how this would affect the election.
Wednesday, Cohen was sentenced to serve 3 years in federal prison for lying to Congress, tax evasion, and campaign finance violations. The president's statements on the payments have changed. In April, he said he was unaware of them.
More recently, the president has called the payments a, quote, simple private transaction. He says the only thing he did wrong was to trust a bad attorney.
Whatever he did on his own.
Raids of Cohen's properties have also led to a criminal investigation into President Trump's inauguration spending. Federal prosecutors want to know if some of the international donors gave money in return for access to the president. Mola Lenghi, CBS News, The White House.
A student at a Washington college admitted in court to spying for Russia.
I'm Tom Foti.
I'm a representative of Russian Federation here.
The 30-year-old Russian woman who attended American University here and once asked candidate Donald Trump about U.S.-Russian relations is now a convicted felon, facing up to 6 months in jail and possible deportation. Maria Butina admitting in federal court she conspired to infiltrate the NRA and other conservative organizations on behalf of Moscow. And although not a part of the Mueller-Russia investigation, Butina does become the first Russian national to plead guilty to a charge related to Russian meddling in the 2016 election. Tom Foti, CBS News, Washington.
A growing international row in Canada where authorities detained the head of Chinese tech company Huawei.
Chinese tech exec Meng Wanzhou walked out of a Canadian courtroom after a judge released her on $10 million bond. Wanzhou, the chief financial officer at Huawei, a Chinese tech giant, is accused of fraud and violating U.S. sanctions against Iran. Her arrest is at the request of the United States and has further complicated the escalating trade war between the Trump administration and China. In an interview with Reuters, President Trump was asked if he would get involved in the case. He said, "Whatever's good for the country, I would do." And added, quote, "I would certainly intervene if I thought it was necessary." Canada accused the Chinese of retaliating with the arrest of Michael Kovrig, a former Canadian diplomat. China claims he was employed by an organization that was not registered in China legally. The State Department expressed concern over the arrest.
We urge China to end all forms of arbitrary detention and to respect the protections and freedoms of all individuals under China's international human rights and consular commitments.
Canada is calling for Kovrig's immediate release. Nicole Killian, CBS News, Washington.
Across the U.S., Thursday, police responded to an onslaught of bomb threats.
The reports of bomb threats spread like wildfire across the country.
This is bomb threat realness.
With mass evacuations from coast to coast. In Des Moines, Iowa, police scrambled to answer a flurry of calls.
In about 40 minutes, we had four businesses here in town get a hold of us and say that they'd received bomb threats.
In San Francisco, calls came in from close to 20 locations.
The types of businesses affected by these bomb threats range from offices, financial institutions.
As the calls came in, officers and...
Good job, buddy.
Bomb-sniffing dogs soon followed. But in every city and small town, the end result was the same.
We have not found any explosive devices or found any of the threats to be credible.
CBS News has learned that in recent weeks, federal law enforcement officials sent a bulletin to local police departments across the country warning of digital ransom threats after 15 states received similar messages between August and November of this year.
The very basic consequences to an attack or even a threat like this is that it costs business, it costs government, it costs taxpayers a lot of time and money.
CNET senior producer Dan Patterson says cyber criminals may be testing new methods to see how we respond.
Inevitably, at some point, we will have to contend with a cyber attack that harms or damages a city may end up resulting in the loss of life.
Correspondent Jeff Pegues reporting investigators suspect the bomb threats made via email may have originated overseas. After a two-day manhunt, police in France found their man. CBS News correspondent Elaine Cobb is at the scene where the suspect in the attack near a Christmas market in Strasbourg, France, was found.
The police say it was reports from Strasbourg citizens that led them to the gunman. More than 800 calls were made to the police call line. Several said they'd seen him in his old neighbourhood, Neudorf. A police patrol spotted a man acting suspiciously. When they backed up to take a closer look, he tried to get into a building but failed. He fired at the police car. They fired back, killing him. The people of Strasbourg are trying to get back to normal life, and the Christmas market where the shooting started has reopened. Elaine Cobb, CBS News, Strasbourg.
Back here in the U.S., the Senate passed a rebuke Thursday to Saudi Arabia and the White House. A rare bipartisan resolution condemns Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman for the murder of Saudi dissident writer Jamal Khashoggi. Senate Foreign Relations Chairman, Tennessee Republican Bob Corker.
I think it speaks to the values that we hold dear.
Connecticut Democrat Chris Murphy.
We are reasserting our responsibility to be a co-equal branch with the executive in foreign policy making.
The Senate also voted to call on the U.S. to withdraw its involvement in the Saudi-backed Yemen war. And there's new details about a secret settlement made by CBS amid the fallout from a sexual harassment investigation following the departure of CEO Les Moonves, according to the New York Times. Here's correspondent Vladimir Dutier.
I need to know whose team you're on.
Eliza Dushku's time on CBS's hit show Bull was brief. She played a lawyer alongside the show's star Michael Weatherly for just three episodes in season one.
Wait a second. Am I being released?
Well, yeah. According to a draft report from lawyers hired by CBS's board and reviewed by the New York Times, Dushku was written off the show within days of confronting Weatherly about behavior that made her uncomfortable. After being written off the show, Dushku entered mediation with CBS. The network agreed this year to pay Dushku a confidential settlement of $9.5 million.
Weatherly apologized in the New York Times for his comments. Coming up, how a young migrant girl died in the custody of U.S. Border Patrol agents. That's next on the Weekend Roundup.
On the CBS News Weekend Roundup, here's correspondent Steve Dorsey.
Google CEO Sundar Pichai faced lawmakers on Capitol Hill Tuesday. More from correspondent Nick Thompson.
We need to be sure that any political bias within Google's workforce does not creep into its search products.
Some Republicans suggested that left-leaning employees could be putting their thumb on the search engine scale.
How do you explain this apparent bias on Google's part against conservative points of view?
Congressman, I understand the frustration at seeing negative news. What is important here is we use a robust methodology to reflect what is being said. I can commit to you and I can assure you, we do it without regards to political ideology.
Democrats pushed back on accusations of political bias.
If you're getting bad press articles and bad search results, don't blame Google or Facebook or Twitter. Consider blaming yourself.
Giant tech companies are coming under increased scrutiny by Congress, concerned about Silicon Valley's growing concentration of power, especially Google's. With billions of queries made each day, more than 90% of all internet searches are on Google platforms. And they spent more than $18 million lobbying Congress in 2017. That's more than any other company.
Sundar handled himself well. He was composed. And after all these hearings, there are no real dings against these companies. In fact, two congressmen held up iPhones while questioning Sundar, which, as we know it, aren't made by Google, but by Apple. Nicholas Thompson, CBS News, New York.
The House and Senate have reached a compromise on legislation to reform their sexual harassment policies.
The House and Senate had passed separate bills earlier this year. One of the big differences was whether members should be held personally, financially responsible for any harassment or discrimination settlements. Previously, those were paid with taxpayer money. The House bill held members personally responsible, while the Senate version did not. Under the compromise, members will be held financially responsible for any harassment or retaliation claims, but they will not be held responsible for discrimination claims. Bill Rakoff, CBS News, Washington.
It's been a wild week in politics in the UK, with British Prime Minister Theresa May clinging to power after she postponed a vote on Brexit in the British Parliament.
Prime Minister Theresa May spoke to Britain after surviving a no-confidence vote.
Following this ballot, we now need to get on with the job of delivering Brexit for the British people and building a better future for this country.
The crucial vote by lawmakers in her own party threatened May's Conservative Party leadership and the future of Brexit.
The result of the ballot held this evening is that the Parliamentary Party does have confidence.
Yeah! 200 Conservative Party members voted in favor of May, while 117 voted against her in the Wednesday evening secret ballot. The confidence vote came just days after May postponed a vote on her Brexit plan that faced almost certain defeat. May's compromise would hold on to Britain's close economic ties with the European Union rather than make a clean break.
Whilst I'm grateful for that support, a significant number of colleagues did cast a vote against me, and I've listened to what they said.
With Brexit less than 4 months away, May says she'll continue to negotiate with European Union leaders. Tina Kraus, CBS News, London.
An investigation is underway into the death of a 7-year-old Guatemalan girl who was in the custody of U.S. Border Patrol agents.
I'm Gary Nunn. Apparently, the little girl was given no food or water for days before she died of shock and dehydration. According to the Washington Post, the child was traveling with her father in a group when she was arrested by agents near Lordsburg, New Mexico, after crossing into the U.S. It is not known what happened to the girl before she began having seizures and was taken to a hospital in El Paso where she died. Gary Nunn, CBS News.
In a statement posted to Facebook, the Department of Homeland Security said Border Patrol agents provided medical care to the child, reviving her twice after she stopped breathing before being medevaced to a hospital. The World Almanac is making some changes next year. Senior editor Sarah Jansen is on the line this weekend. Sarah, thanks for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
You've got some new statistics on stories we've been following closely, including crime, trade, and immigration.
There's information about refugee counts, asylee status, about crime in various U.S. cities and how it compares over time. There's a lot of really great new information in there that I think people will find useful when they're looking at the news.
Are there any trends that stick out to you?
Well, certainly in terms of immigration, and this is something that does come up pretty frequently in the talk about what's going on at the border and elsewhere, the refugee number that is set by the president has basically been cut in half the last 2 years each. So that's been an interesting thing to note. It's a pretty big change to go down to 30,000 from almost 100,000. I think that sort of colors the debate on a different side of things.
Another important topic, taxes. Lots changing soon for how we do our returns in 2019.
Yeah, I think the tax bill is a story that maybe got lost a little bit because it was passed at the end of 2017. And, of course, these kinds of changes don't go into effect really. You don't feel it anyway until the next tax year filing. So we'll be looking at for filing taxes in 2019 for tax year 2018. All of those changes are really going to take effect for Americans. And I think that the background information that the World Almanac provides can give really great context to that.
Finally, Sarah, another important focus, election results. How does that shape our country?
Well, obviously, the midterm elections were a huge story in 2018, and of course will have a tremendous impact once the new Congress is seated in January. We were looking at the story both in terms of the numbers in turnout, which was historically high, as I think most people know at this point, but also in terms of campaign spending, which campaigns were having the biggest donations from different sources, super PACs, et cetera. So it's definitely a place that I think people find interesting, especially as they're looking at some of the new members of Congress and how the donations came in along different lines.
And of course, many of those new members in Congress are women, are diverse, and that's changing the face of Capitol Hill.
Absolutely. It's a historically diverse class. Over 100 women are going to be seated. That's a first ever for the House. So it's definitely an interesting time to be looking at politics and to see how representation is changing.
World Almanac Senior Editor Sarah Jansen on the Weekend Roundup. Good talking with you, Sarah.
Thank you so much for having me.
New concerns about a common diagnostic tool found in medical facilities across the world.
Getting sick in the hospital has become a problem in recent years, and there's more of an effort these days to identify just how germs are spread inside medical facilities. Well, a new study found stethoscopes can be laden with a wide range of bacteria, including Staphylococcus aureus, which can cause serious skin and respiratory infections, including pneumonia. The study authors are calling for strict use of CDC decontamination recommendations or the use of single-patient stethoscopes kept in each patient's room. Jim Shenavy, CBS News.
Up next, a fraternity president accused of rape strikes a deal to avoid jail time.
So we see time and time again everything from the national level down to the local level of mainly men getting away with things like this.
On the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
The CBS News Weekend Roundup after this short break.
CBS News Radio presents the Intelligence Matters Podcast, taking you inside the biggest stories in national security.
How concerned are you?
I'm concerned that the Russians never left.
Each week, former acting director of the CIA, Michael Morell, interviews top leaders from the U.S. intelligence community.
James Clapper, Senator Mark Warner of Virginia, Mike Hayden.
And lucky for you, you won't need a security clearance to listen. The Intelligence Matters Podcast. Subscribe now on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or Stitcher. From the Capital One Bank Studios in Washington, this is the CBS News Weekend Roundup. Here's correspondent Steve Dorsey.
In uproar after a college fraternity president accused of rape avoided jail time with a plea deal. More from CBS News correspondent Omar Villafranca at Baylor University in Waco, Texas.
Mr. Anderson.
Jacob Anderson had little to say as he left a Waco courthouse Monday after being spared prison time, despite being indicted on 4 counts of sexual assault. His alleged victim told police, in 2016, the former Baylor fraternity president repeatedly raped her at an off-campus house party where alcohol was served. Following Monday's plea agreement, the woman, known as Donna Doe, addressed the judge in court. "I am devastated by your decision. He stole my virginity and power over my body, and you let him keep it for all eternity."
Do the women on campus talk about this?
Yeah.
Baylor graduate student Aaron Albin started an online petition expressing outrage over the deal. More than 85,000 people have signed it.
Why do you think there was that much response?
I think people are finally realizing that this is a problem and that survivors aren't taken seriously. So we see time and time again everything from the national level down to the local level of a lot of people, mainly men, getting away with things like this.
This is at least the third time Judge Strother has approved probation for men accused of sexually assaulting Baylor students. Once after a guilty plea in a 2013 rape case, and another earlier this year that included a 30-day jail sentence served on weekends. In a statement Monday, prosecutor Hillary Laborde said Anderson's plea deal was the best outcome given the facts of the case. Conflicting evidence and statements exist, making the original allegation difficult to prove beyond a reasonable doubt. She says all the facts must be considered, and there's information that hasn't been made public.
In court, the judge said there is a lot of information the public does not know about this case. So we reached out to the judge to try to learn more, but he did not return our calls or emails. Omar Villafranca, CBS News, Waco, Texas.
An Alabama mother who says bullying led to her daughter's suicide believes her school didn't do enough to protect her. Fourth grader Mackenzie Adams took her own life. Her mother says she was a constant target of racial taunts and name-calling. Correspondent DeMarco Morgan spoke with Mackenzie's mother.
My baby, she was happy. She was joyful.
Jasmine Adams says after her daughter, Mackenzie, started fourth grade at U.S. Jones Elementary School, the nine-year-old started complaining about problems with her classmates.
There were children picking on her.
Jasmine says she voiced her concerns to school officials, who she says reassured her they would keep an eye on her daughter. But on the morning of December 3rd, Mackenzie took her own life in her family's home. The results of a police investigation are still pending, but so far, police say they have found no evidence the school knew of the bullying. The Demopolis City School System offered its condolences to the family, but says its own internal investigation concluded there have been no findings of any reports of bullying by either the student or family.
I don't know why they would say they knew nothing about it, but they did.
Mackenzie's death is part of a sobering trend in the U.S. While the causes are unclear, the suicide rate for children ages 5 to 14 has almost tripled since 2007. Jasmine Adams is imploring school officials to stay alert to bullying by their students.
You have my child 8 hours a day. So that means that we have to trust you to do the right thing when it comes to the safety of my child. And they didn't do that. And it hurts.
Experts say there are signs to be on the lookout for when it comes to your child being bullied. Look for unwillingness to want to go to school, falling grades, and sleepless nights. DeMarco Morgan, CBS News, Demopolis, Alabama.
New research finds later school start times help kids do better.
Mornings are a little easier for Hazel Ostrowski, a senior at Franklin High School in Seattle. She's able to sleep in a bit longer thanks to a later start time of 8:45 set in place by her school district 2 years ago.
I think I definitely felt more awake when I had an extra hour of sleep.
Hazel was one of more than 170 students who took part in a new study published Wednesday in the journal Science Advances. It found when school started later, students slept longer and their academic performance improved.
I think that that really helped me complete my schoolwork, but also just be more interested in what I was learning.
Researchers used wrist monitors to measure how long two different groups of sophomores slept. One group was monitored in 2016 when school started at 7:50 a.m., and the other group in 2017 when classes began almost an hour later at 8:45 a.m. Students who started class later slept an extra 34 minutes on school nights, and their grades improved an average of 4.5%.
I have seen that there are far fewer tardies and absences in first period.
A.J. Katsaroff is Hazel's biology teacher. She worked with researchers on the study and saw improved student performance firsthand.
I see kids are generally more engaged in the work of the classroom, so very much more willing to participate than in the past.
While the study has shown positive results for students' health and academics, it did not address potentially negative impacts on their after-school activities, which now might take place after dark.
When you push the time back, can be kind of difficult.
Dr. Tara Narula reporting. Another record number of holiday travelers expected for the Christmas rush.
Christine Aloisi will be flying from Florida to New Jersey for Christmas.
What are you doing in Jersey? What are your plans?
Visiting family, going to Atlantic City, all the fun stuff.
According to a new report from AAA, she's one of a record 112 million people traveling more than 50 miles this holiday season.
That is the highest travel volume for end-of-year travel on record since we've been tracking in 2001.
AAA's Tamara Johnson says for the seventh straight year, travel between December 22nd and January 1st is reaching a new high.
We really are attributing the increase to the strength of the economy. We see that consumer spending is strong and also unemployment is low.
102 million drivers will be on the road this year, up 4% from last year, fueled by falling gas prices. Nearly 7 million people will be flying, also up 4% from last year.
A lot more of my friends were talking about staying home and staycations last year, and then this year everyone's talking about where they're going and what they're doing.
AAA says the busiest days to fly will be December 22nd, December 23rd, and the 26th.
Lots of people, lots of folks with lots of kids, lots of people who don't travel often.
Dan Cook says he isn't worried about the crowds.
A couple hours at the airport, who cares? You're going to have a lot of time over the holidays. Just enjoy some food and enjoy family and friends.
As always, flying during the holiday means higher prices. The average cost for a ticket on the busiest days is nearly $600 round trip. Hillary Lane, CBS News, New York.
Coming up on the weekend roundup, on the ground in the Florida Panhandle.
Hurricane Michael came ashore in Mexico Beach. It flattened much of a lovely old Florida town.
Follow us on Twitter. We've got headlines at CBS News Radio. And I'm tweeting at Steve_Dorsey on the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
On the CBS News Weekend Roundup, here's correspondent Steve Dorsey.
A team of medical specialists has released a new report on the Americans injured in Havana, Cuba, a story CBS News first broke. The doctors were the first to treat the U.S. diplomats. I traveled to Miami, where the victims were treated.
The diplomats came from the U.S. Embassy in Havana to the University of Miami complaining of noises or pressure in their ears.
Their primary complaints were of dizziness and disorientation. Some of them also complained of auditory concerns or hearing concerns.
Doctors say their findings show clear evidence that at least 25 have a problem with their inner ear. The injuries were to the vestibular system that detects gravity. Doctors say this type of injury can affect the brain.
They had objective tests that showed an abnormality. And those tests cannot be faked.
When the problems were first reported, U.S. officials suggested the Cuban government was engaging in some kind of auditory attack. The Cuban government has denied any wrongdoing.
Doctors here at the University of Miami say they don't know how those injuries occurred, but that they're highly suspicious and worth further study.
When this many people present with this amount of disability, it's hard to imagine that this just arises by chance in all of these individuals.
Attorney Mark Zaid represents 8 of the patients.
They do want answers. It has been 2 years. We still don't know anything publicly.
He says some of his clients are still unable to work and others are undergoing rehabilitation.
Growing scrutiny of a video showing a Miami Beach police officer punching out a black man.
Police say a confrontation soon began between Joel Poitier and Officer Adriel Dominguez with one swing. The officer knocked Poitier out cold. According to the police report, Poitier clenched his fist and took a fighting stance, causing the officer to fear for his safety. Poitier was arrested and charged with assault, resisting an officer, and disorderly conduct for actions allegedly not seen on video.
He thought it was outrageous. He thought it was really sickening.
Michael Pizzi is the attorney for Frederick Dominguez, an officer who was not at the scene that night. Pizzi says his client heard about the incident from fellow officers and decided to find the video from the department's body cam footage.
After a week went by and nobody did anything to expose it, nobody investigated it, and the report was fabricated, Officer Dominguez felt that he had an obligation to come forward and achieve justice.
The Miami Beach Police Union strongly defended the officer in the video, writing, "There is no question Officer Adriel Dominguez was legally justified and fully entitled to protect himself." Miami but Pizzi disagrees and says like his client now fears retaliation.
I hope the police chief and Miami Beach sends a message that they are going to encourage people to come forward and report misconduct, and they're going to protect people who show integrity and who show bravery and do the right thing.
Correspondent Jerika Duncan reporting. Hurricane Michael slammed into the Florida Panhandle 2 months ago, but challenges still remain to rebuilding many parts of the region. Here's our correspondent Peter King, who visited the area to report on a CBS News series on the recovery.
Much of the country has moved on, but life here in the Panhandle can be a daily nightmare. There's still a state of emergency. Thousands of people are out of their homes because they've either been destroyed or badly damaged. Some people are with family, others in hotels and motels, and many have simply left the area. Repairs are slow because there just aren't enough contractors to go around. Some people are still waiting for power. Affordable housing? Well, that's a huge problem and will continue to be. Debris? It's everywhere. In Panama City, the mayor says they've removed more than 18 years' worth since the storm, and that's still less than half of what has to be taken away. No block is without damage or devastation, and because of the dangers, pharmacies are promoting tetanus shots on their outdoor signs. Many street signs are missing. So many neighborhoods are unrecognizable. Even locals need GPS to navigate them. Heavy traffic, and that's the new normal. A phrase, by the way, people here love to hate. Traffic lights aren't synchronized. Utility and debris crews sometimes have to block lanes to do their work. What used to be a short drive can now take an hour and a half or longer. Hurricane Michael came ashore in Mexico Beach. It flattened much of a lovely old Florida town. Many think it's just a rich people's paradise, but it's small businesses and homes belonging to full-time residents who own and operate them are mostly gone. Those people aren't rich, and now they have to figure out whether to stay or go. Many have already left. Many jobs are gone. It could take years to repair all the damage at Tyndall Air Force Base. Some 1,300 jobs are disappearing with the shutdown of a big mall and the much-reduced capacity of a hospital when it reopens. There's sadness and desperation here. I met a high school senior who has to work full-time to help pay her family's bills. More than once, I've seen people going through debris and trash on the side of the road to see if there's something they can use. There is progress. Businesses are rebuilding and hiring. Volunteers from here and around the country are still providing medical help, free meals, food, and other supplies. Communities are holding holiday parades and other events. Toy and clothing drives have helped. There's a new bipartisan effort by former and current elected officials to make sure people here aren't forgotten. Neighbors are still helping neighbors, and these cities and towns plan to rebuild better and stronger to survive future storms. That, of course, will take years, but I keep hearing over and over again that Northwest Florida is resilient, like the signs I've seen everywhere here, referring to the region's area code. They say they are 850 strong. I'm Peter King, CBS News, Panama City, Florida.
Three people were safely rescued after trespassing into a West Virginia coal mine.
I'm Jim Crisul in Whitesville, West Virginia. Greg Scarborough's 21-year-old grandson, Cody Beverly, was among the three people rescued from an abandoned coal mine after spending 111 hours underground.
Inside, in my mind, I was trying to figure out how I was going to bury my grandson.
Dozens of family members in this close-knit, down-and-out town screamed in joy, cheered, hugged, and wept after what many are calling a West Virginia Christmas miracle. Jim Crisul, CBS News, Whitesville, West Virginia.
The Raleigh County Sheriff now investigating why the three were in the mine. Prosecutors are going after people who steal from movie and TV producers.
Five men, none of whom are in the United States, have been indicted for allegedly running an international ring that pirated hundreds of movies and TV shows, including 50 Shades of Grey, Godzilla, and The Walking Dead. The indictment charges the men hacked computer systems used by Hollywood film production companies to steal digital files, recorded movie theater screenings, and got copies of movies sent to industry professionals. They live in the UK, India, Malaysia, and the United Arab Emirates. None has been arrested yet. Pam Coulter, CBS News.
Thursday, I don't care about you. It's Friday. I'm in love.
The Cure makes the list for next year's inductees into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Also getting in Def Leppard, Janet Jackson, The Zombies, Roxy Music, Radiohead, and Stevie Nicks. As a solo artist, she's already there as a member of Fleetwood Mac. Coming up to space and beyond.
That's our aim, is to try to make it safe and affordable for as many people as possible.
On the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
The CBS News Weekend Roundup after this short break.
This is The Takeout with Major Garrett.
Every week, an extended conversation at a restaurant in our nation's capital with newsmakers like Democratic Senator Mark Warner.
What we want to try to do is give the American people the truth.
Trump cabinet member Linda McMahon.
First time that I met Donald Trump was at a Rolling Stones concert.
Neil deGrasse Tyson. He has keys to the universe.
Actually, it's a key fob.
Right. You have a fob to the universe. Politics, policy, and a side of pop culture. The Takeout with me, Major Garrett.
On the CBS News Weekend Roundup, here's correspondent Steve Dorsey.
The mother of a missing Colorado woman is revealing new information about the day her daughter vanished. No one's reported seeing Kelsey Barrett since her fiancé picked up their one-year-old daughter 3 weeks ago.
I think she wants to be found.
Cheryl Barrett spoke with Kelsey on the phone Thanksgiving morning, shortly before the 29-year-old went shopping with her daughter Kaylee at a Woodland Park, Colorado supermarket.
Did she say what her Thanksgiving plans were?
There was the possibility of going out to dinner.
After her fiancé, Patrick Frazee, who is also Kaylee's father, picked up the one-year-old, Barrett vanished. 3 days later, on November 25th, cell towers outside Gooding, Idaho, nearly 600 miles away, picked up a signal from Barrett's phone. Her parents live in the northern part of the state.
Did Kelsey have any plans? Did she mention to you at all that she might be heading to Idaho?
No.
Is there any chance she would have just planned to week away? Is there any chance she was just stressed out?
I seriously doubt it.
Frazee says he also got a text message from Barrett on November 25th, but nothing since. He never reported her missing. Police say Frazee is not a suspect and is cooperating with the investigation.
I'm hopeful that she'll be found completely, 100%, safely.
Frazee's lawyer says his client, who is hoping for Kelsey's safe return, has been caring for their daughter, Kaylee. Idaho State Police tell CBS News they did look into those cell phone tower pings, but so far they have no active leads. Nikki Batiste, CBS News, Woodland Park, Colorado.
Now to the decades-old case of another missing woman, Jody Huizentrout. The Mason City, Iowa TV anchor was last seen 23 years ago, but correspondent Jim Axelrod is revealing new information this weekend on 48 Hours about her disappearance. Jim, remind us first who Jody was and how she was first reported missing.
In June of 1995, Jody Huizentrout was the morning anchor at KIMT-TV, and she just didn't show up for her shift one morning. And they obviously became very concerned, so this started an investigation, and they got to the parking lot where it appeared there were signs of struggle at her car. She had been called by a producer, said she'd overslept. She was making her way to the station. She never got there. And that was the last anybody saw of Jody. And they've never made an arrest in the case.
And who was John Van Cise then?
So John Van Cise was one of the chief persons of interest, I suppose you would call him. He was in her inner circle, a friend, 22 years older, and he used to say that Jody was like a daughter to him, although people close to Jody said John had other ideas, that they thought he wanted to date Jody. But he's not the only person who's drawn interest of law enforcement over the years. There's a guy named Tony Jackson. He was a serial rapist convicted of several crimes in the Minneapolis-St. Paul area in the late 90s. But in 1995, in June of 95, when Jody disappeared, Tony Jackson was living in Mason City, Iowa, two blocks from the television station.
This weekend, you've got some new footage that you've dug up.
So 23 years ago, when all of this sort of broke, 48 Hours was on the ground in Mason City, Iowa, and they were documenting everything that was going on, hoping they would be telling a positive story of Jody turning up. Not the case. The story never aired. It just, because the story just sort of frittered along over the next several years as this investigation fruitlessly unfolded. But we had all the video. So for the first time, we'll be showing 23-year-old video of John Van Cise, of what happened, some of Jody's friends, the investigation, and it'll just help set the stage for also some new information that we are able to share with our audience.
CBS News correspondent Jim Axelrod on his 48 Hours investigation into this decades-long disappearance and mystery of Jody Huizentrout. You can catch 48 Hours on Saturday nights on CBS TV or stream at any time on CBS All Access. Thanks a lot, Jim.
Thank you, Steve.
A milestone on the way to space.
An aircraft carrying the Virgin Spaceship 2 took off from California's Mojave Desert Thursday morning on its way to the edge of space. At 45,000 feet, the aircraft released the Spaceship 2, which rocketed more than 51 miles above the Earth.
Rolling to the right.
On board, two test pilots and a mannequin representing a future passenger. It landed safely minutes later. Virgin Galactic founder Richard Branson.
I'm really hopeful that a lot of people watching your program one day will be able to go to space. And that's our aim, is to try to make it safe and affordable for as many people as possible.
Branson is competing with fellow billionaires Jeff Bezos and Elon Musk in the race to get tourists to space. The rides are priced around $250,000. Branson says he wants to be one of the first to go.
I'm itching to go. My guess is within 6 months.
Thursday's successful launch comes 4 years after an earlier craft crashed during a test flight, killing one pilot and injuring the other. The pilots of this flight, including former NASA astronaut Frederick Sterko, will be awarded commercial astronaut wings from the FAA. Tom Hansen, CBS News.
Finally this weekend, new additions this year to the Library of Congress National Film Registry, many with familiar tunes. Here's correspondent Steve Futterman in Los Angeles.
The rain in Spain stays mainly in the plain.
I think she's got it.
The list includes a number of musicals.
The rain in Spain stays mainly in the plain.
The classic 1964 hit My Fair Lady. There is also a legendary Disney film.
Salagadoola, Menchikaboola, Bibbidi-Bobbidi-Boo.
Cinderella.
Put them together and what have you got? Bibbidi-Bobbidi-Boo.
Now, we never been here before.
And the 1949 hit On the Town, starring Frank Sinatra and Gene Kelly.
New York, New York, a wonderful town. The rocks is up and the battery's down. The people ride in a hole in the ground. New York, New York, it's a wonderful town.
One of Steven Spielberg's memorable films makes the list.
Welcome to Jurassic Park.
Along with a Stanley Kubrick horror film, The Shining.
Here's Johnny.
Rebecca becomes the eighth Alfred Hitchcock film to make the registry.
Why do you hate me? What have I done to you that you should ever hate me so?
You tried to take her place. You let him marry you.
Along with the 1962 drama. And there is even one film that will touch the hearts of reporters. Broadcast News.
It must be nice to always believe you know better. To always think you're the smartest person in the room.
No, it's awful.
Steve Futterman, CBS News, Los Angeles.
That does it for the Weekend Roundup. Thanks for listening. The show is always online on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher, and Spotify. We want to get your feedback. Drop us a line at weekendroundup@cbsnews.com and let us know where and how you're listening. The Weekend Roundup is produced at the CBS News Washington Bureau. Lou Walker is the technical supervisor. Have a great week. I'm Steve Dorsey, CBS News.